Okay, so we're getting introduced into this new book of Judges. The book itself is known for the judges that arise periodically throughout the course of Israel's history to deliver them from the hand of their enemies. When they fall into captivity of their enemies, God would bring up a judge. He would raise up a judge, and the judge in turn would deliver Israel for a period of time and act in some cases as somewhat as a spiritual leader for the people. Chapters 1 through 3 really help us understand and bring us to the point of what brings about the judges. And as we started in chapter 1, we see the death of Joshua and the conquest of the land as it soon begins. And verses 27 through 36 that we're going to look at in a moment are really pivotal in understanding what's going to take place in chapter 2 and all throughout the rest of the chapter. But in verses 22 through 26 that we read, what does that account where you've got Ephraim and Manasseh? I think my Bible refers to it as the house of Joseph. You remember Joseph's two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh, are broken down, and each had their own individual tribe. But as these two tribes prepare to go into their inheritance, what does this account remind you of?
Jericho.
Okay, kind of reminds you of Jericho. It's got some very similar elements there. Worked with Jericho, so they sent spies to the place that they were going to prepare to capture. They make contact with one of the citizens, kind of like the Israelites, the two spies did with Rahab whenever they made it into Jericho. And they offer this request for help. And by doing so, if you help us, then we'll give you this reward. And in verse 24, we see that there was a man coming out of the city. And I found it kind of odd that they asked this man, where's the entrance to the city? You wouldn't think that would be very hard to figure out. Where's the city gate? How do we get into the city? And there's been some archaeology that was done, and it's been discovered that this old ancient city actually had somewhat of a small underground tunnel that led up into the middle of the citadel. And it was large enough just for one person to pass through at a time. And so they're asking what seems to be a very obvious question. Chances are they're looking for some sort of a way to secretly go into the city that might make their attack more successful. They'll have that element of surprise. And so they offer to this man, if you treat us kindly, then we'll treat you kindly. We'll spare you and we'll spare your family. And this process allowed for the tribes of Joseph to, in turn, take the city of Bethel or Luz more easily whenever they actually entered in and began that assault. But do you see a mistake here that was made by the Ephraimites in this text? What was it God told them on the outset of the conquest of the land of Canaan?
Kill them all.
You're not supposed to spare anyone. You're not supposed to make any deals. You're not supposed to allow any of the people to live. You're supposed to just go in and destroy all of these people. But yet we see the Ephraimites here, and we talked a little bit about it last week, how you've got Judah who goes to Simeon and says, hey, come help us, and we'll in turn help you. They went and consulted with God. God said, Judah shall go up. Judah goes outside of the realm of what God had said to do, and he goes to Simeon. They have some sort of alliance. And as a result of that, they go outside what it was God had spoken. And so once again, we see them bypassing the command that God gave when he said, you're to destroy the city. You're not to make any covenants, any promises to any people, to spare any of them. You're to destroy them all. And so they go and they spare this man here. And the result of that being, he then went into the land of the Hittites. He built a city, and he named it Luz, which is the name of the city to this day. So the city that they went and destroyed, this guy actually goes and he just rebuilds. You remember a slight difference in the Jericho story. Rahab and her family, they were integrated into Israel. It says she lived in the camp of Israel unto this day. This guy here, he goes and he takes his gods and he takes his family and he takes his pagan lifestyle and he plants another city right there amongst the Ephraimites. And so we're going to see this compromising nature really come back and bite the Israelites whenever they disobeyed the command of God in this particular text. And it's in verses 25 and 26 where they let this man and his family go. So let's move on and let's conclude the rest of the chapter, verses 27 through 36. And I'm going to make an attempt at reading this. It's kind of some challenging names we've got here, so I'll be the one to butcher those this time. Picking up our reading in verse 27. But Manasseh did not take possession of Beth Shean and its villages or Taanach and its villages or the inhabitants of Dor and its villages or the inhabitants of Iblim and its villages or the inhabitants of Megiddo and its villages. And so the Canaanites persisted in living in that land. And it came about when Israel became strong that they put the Canaanites to forced labor, but they did not drive them out completely. Ephraim did not drive out the Canaanites who were living in Gezer, and so the Canaanites lived in Gezer among them. Zebulun did not drive out the inhabitants of Kitron or the inhabitants of Nahalal, so the Canaanites lived among them and became subject to forced labor. Asher did not drive out the inhabitants of Aco or the inhabitants of Sidon or Alab or Achzib or Helba or Aphek or Rehob, and so the Asherites lived among the Canaanites, the inhabitants of the land, for they did not drive them out. Naphtali did not drive out the inhabitants of Beth-Shemesh or the inhabitants of Beth-Anath, but lived among the Canaanites. The inhabitants of the land and the inhabitants of Beth-Shemesh and Beth-Anath became forced labor for them. And the Amorites forced the sons of Dan into the hill country, for they did not allow them to come down to the valley. Yet the Amorites persisted in living in the Mount Heres, in Ajalon, and in Shealbim. But the power of the house of Joseph grew strong. They became forced labor. And so the border of the Amorites ran from the ascent of Akrabim, from Selah, and upward. That's a mouthful. So we see here, really what I'm going to simply describe, it's the beginning of Israel's independence as a nation. They're receiving the promised land that God had made all the way back to Abraham. But the compromising nature of the way that they deal with the Canaanites when God said you're to destroy them all really is going to spell the end for the Israelites. And it's early in their rule as a nation, but I really think things are just going to start going downhill from here, as the book of Judges is soon going to tell us. And as you read through this, you may wonder, well, what is the point of this text? It seems like just a bunch of geography, and let's just all be honest, nobody really likes geography. So what can we, as Christians who are living some 3,500 years removed from this ancient book of geography or text of geography, what good does this do for us? Well, we'll need to remember that God gave this initial command, destroy all the Canaanites. They failed to do so. This isn't the first time, though, that Israel failed to do as God commanded with that. Can you think back to the book of Joshua, where there was an event that kind of set the tone for what we see many of the tribes of Israel doing here? It was with a people from Gibeon. And they go to Joshua, and they actually play some sort of trick on Joshua, pretending that they're weary travelers and saying, make peace with us, when actually they were inhabitants of the land that Israel was supposed to be destroying. However, Joshua promises, he doesn't consult God, he promises peace with them, and as a result of that, when he finds out about it, that the Gibeonites were deceiving him, they subject them to forced labor, but they do not destroy them. And what we see here in this text, more so than just this ancient book of geography and text of geography, you've got this phrase that's repeated seven times. And we understand the meaning of seven from our Daniel class. God is charging Israel with their wrong, their violation of their covenant. Remember, he's promised to give them the land and to give them wells and cities and all sorts of things that they themselves haven't earned or deserve. However, they've got a responsibility to keep the commands of the Lord and to utterly drive out the Canaanites. And so God is bringing a charge in this text against his people. Verse 29, Ephraim did not drive out the Canaanites. Zebulun did not drive out the Canaanites. And so seven times the writer is recording this. What he's doing is he's charging God's people, saying this is the breach of contract that's taking place. God's promised you the land, but you've not done what it was that you were supposed to do in driving out the people of the land. And you think about the purpose behind that. Well, God, why did you tell Israel to absolutely kill all of the people? Well, there were practical reasons that Israel was to drive out the land, the Canaanites from the land. There were certain cities. Verse 27 mentions one, Beth-Shean. That was a site that kind of stood between the Jordan and Jezreel valleys. And so it was a very strategic location. And we see here that the Canaanites really hunkered down there, and the Israelites weren't able to drive them out. And so they lost what was a very significant piece of land that they should have had from Canaan. Verse 27, also you got Taanach, Ibleam, and Megiddo. There were crucial fortresses, Canaanite fortresses, each of those, that if the Israelites would have taken them, they in turn would have solidified and fortified their defenses and protection of the land, if they would have just taken those cities in verse 27. Strategically, they were very valuable. And there would have been major benefits had the children of Israel taken all of the land of Canaan like God had commanded them to. But the purpose for destroying the Canaanites was deeper than just the strategical benefits of capturing the various cities and fortresses that they failed to capture. The true purpose was spiritual in nature. And I think we read this earlier, but we go back to Exodus 23. God speaking to Moses, the predecessor of Joshua, who's now died in the book of Judges. And he says, from the very inception of this quest, you shall make no covenant with them or with their gods. They shall not live in your land, because they will make you sin against me. For if you serve their gods, it will surely be a snare to you. And so way back from the get-go, when God is speaking to Moses, before they even begin to take the land of Canaan after they cross the Jordan River, God says, if you let the Canaanites stay and you leave their gods there, they're going to be a snare to you and they're going to cause you to sin. And so it wasn't so much of just a military failure that took place here, and that they lost some strategic cities. More so, what's really taking place is this spiritual cancer was allowed to live in the land that they were going to inhabit for the next 1,000 years or so. And so when the author, he writes, they did not dispossess them, that rings with spiritual emergency. What would you think about a surgeon that was going to go in and remove some cancerous part that had begun to grow within the body? And then he just said, well, you know, I'm going to leave a little bit of it there. It's just a little bit. It's not going to cause any real big damage, is it? We understand how medically that would be a very atrocious and terrible thing to do, because that cancer is going to grow and it's going to multiply. And by allowing some of the Canaanites to dwell in the land, maybe they rationalized and said, you know, it's just a handful. What can just a few Canaanites do? How can they really bring about the downfall of Israel? Well, it's a spiritual cancer, and it began to grow. And so as a result of that, we're going to see the effect of that when we read through the rest of the book of Judges. And so let's stop for a moment. Let's talk about question 7, if you've got your sheets. So what we see repeated in this text here is that Canaanites continued to dwell in the land, and the children of Israel, in turn, would subject them to forced labor. Now, do you think this was a good move, or do you think this was a bad move? Think it was a bad move? Can you rationalize some good out of it, though? Maybe if you're an Israelite and you're thinking, I don't want to get out there and do that bone-breaking work. I don't want to be out there doing all of that physical labor and cutting the stone and the building and the farming and all of the work that's going to be required for us to dwell in this land to be successful. Hey, let's make some slaves. Let's use these Canaanites. They're already here, and we'll just subject them to the hard labor that we otherwise would have to do. Now, when you stop and you think about it from that perspective, it doesn't seem like a real bad idea, does it? But as Dick said, when you stop and you understand, remember God's command back in Exodus 23 was these people were going to spiritually lead you away from me. And as a result of that, they're going to cause you to sin. That's the purpose of completely driving them out. And so while it might have made sense from a physical perspective to allow some of the Canaanites to stay, and note, we saw that last week, and we talked a little bit about, they weren't able to drive them all out. Some says they had the iron chariots, and they weren't able to drive the ones with the iron chariots out. But note here, as we were reading, the idea changes. You see that these various tribes are growing strong. And it says when they grew strong. That means they would have had the strength to have driven the Canaanites out or to completely demolish them in war or whatever the case might have been, to eradicate them completely. They grew strong to the point where they could have done something about it and done what God had commanded them to do. But yet when they grew strong rather than obeying God, they subjected them to forced labor. And so from a practical standpoint, you know, this isn't a real bad move. But from a spiritual standpoint, it's absolutely detrimental. It's the doctor that leaves a little bit of cancer in, which is going to grow and spread throughout the rest of the body and permeate the entirety. And so the fact that they were unable to do so initially, but verse 28 says, they grew strong, Israel became strong, rather than obeying God and completely getting rid of them, they compromised. They put them to work, which might have seemed a good idea to them. I don't know. And you come to the end of Judges 1, it's clearly a successful Israelite campaign, isn't it? They've taken over most of the land. They've driven out most of the Canaanites. Yes, there's some disobedience there. There's a pragmatic success, but there's spiritual failure, absolutely. So we come to the end of the chapter. Let's stop and let's think about this. Let me open this really up for discussion. I'd like to hear some of your thoughts. You know, from the course of not just the verses we've read today, but going all the way back to verse 1, the last couple of classes we've had, we read about this. How can I make application in my life? How do you make application in your life? You know, if we read these ancient stories, they may be entertaining, But the purpose of us studying this book is not to memorize the facts of the book of Judges or memorize the judges or walk away having been interested in the material we're learning. The point of everything we do is for edification so that we can walk closer to God. So as we read through Judges 1, what are some things that you might say will help us in our walk with God today? Okay. God gives his law and his commands. A lot of people look at those as these are barriers. These are fences that God is using to prevent me from enjoying life and having a good time, when in actuality, they're to protect us. And that's what we see with Israel. They were to remove the Canaanites for their own good. It was for their own protection and their own benefit that they were commanded to do these things. And so rather than seeing God's commands in the New Testament is binding and is restrictive and is debilitating, we need to understand that what God's actually doing, he's protecting and preserving his people. Miss Johnny? Okay. They allowed them to stay, and the result of that was there was a little bit of influence that then began to spread throughout the people. And I think I've actually got that verse cited in chapter 2 that we're going to look at. So we'll visit that a little bit later in chapter 2, but that's a good point. They allowed them to stay, and they learned the ways of the Canaanites. Johnny?
You know, Israelites were nomadic people.
Y'all, Johnny's an IT guy, and I'm convinced that he hacked into my computer and read my notes for chapter 2. So, but he's exactly right, and we're gonna see how exactly it was that the worship of the Canaanite gods appealed to the children of Israel. And he's exactly right. We face the same sort of temptations today that they do. Yeah, they're manifested in different ways, but it all goes back to the same thing. Satan from the Garden of Eden has never really changed the way that he tempts mankind. And we face different things today, but it all goes back to the same thing, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eye, and the pride of life. It's a good point. John?
You look at when the children of Israel came to the promised land, and he sent 12 tribes, or 12 spies into the land. Two came back with a lot of God punished a generation for that. They wandered in the wilderness for 40 years. That generation was gone. A new generation came. Then they went into to the promised land, and then they began to not take the land that God told them to. That, in turn, punished for generations to come. They have always caused one mistake that they made of not driving out
some 400 years, a little more than 400 years, we're going to see Israel in this perpetual cycle of idolatry. And it's really, as John says, it goes back to the point, they simply didn't do what God had said. God said, drive out the Canaanites. They allowed them to stay. What you're going to find, Israel's going to have a period of peace spiritually and be right with God during the reign of David. Maybe a little bit some during the reign of Saul. But shortly after that, you're going to have Solomon come along. He's going to go after foreign gods. You're going to have Jeroboam. He's going to come along. He's going to put up some idols in the land of Israel. And the people are going to bow down to idols. And throughout their history, you go and you read about the account of the various kings that are going to arise in Israel. And the phrase is used, they didn't pull down the high places. They allowed just a little bit of it to remain. Yeah, they may drive out the Canaanites. Yeah, they may get rid of the pagan temples. But they allowed the high places to remain. And it wasn't until Josiah came along that they completely and utterly destroyed every abomination in Israel. And it goes back to what we see here, allowing just a little bit of the Canaanites to remain. And the result is spiritual separation from God. You see that here, this deterioration that takes place in their life as they go after their idols and their gods and the infidelity that takes place between God and His people. Where if they just would have obeyed God, they wouldn't have had to deal with this. Good point. Virgil?
Application that I made out of this chapter was that God told Israel to drive them all out. And when it's over, Israel looks at one another and says, boy, we did good. And somebody says, oops, there's still some left. They said, oh yeah, but all they are slaves. So they justified their faith. We got to be very careful that we don't justify our faith.
Good point. So, any other application that we might make? Tell you what, let's look at our last question. I'll come back in a moment. I made a couple of observations that I'll share. Does anyone else have any application they want to share from the text, Judges 1? Okay, let's go back all the way to question 1, where I asked you to write down a question that you wanted to see answered by the time we completed the chapter. Well, we've completed the chapter. Did anyone have anything that wasn't answered that they initially wrote down that they want to ask and put me on the spot and let me embarrass myself with? Well, that must mean I did a pretty good job teaching Judges 1 if we answered all of the questions then that everybody had on the outset. But there's some strange things taking place in Judges 1. So if you've got questions along the way, or if you don't want to do it even in a public nature, holler at me after class. Get me after class and just say, hey, I was wanting to see a little more about this, or this wasn't really clear, or I didn't understand this taking place. If you want to shoot me an email, that's fine too. Just let me know one way or the other. I want to make sure that all of our questions are answered as we go into the chapter. Well, let me take a few moments and just share a couple of lessons that I kind of walk away with after studying this first chapter of the book of Judges. Verse 1 stood out to me for one. It came about after the death of Joshua, the sons of Israel inquired of the Lord. You think about Joshua, and you think about leadership. He represented, and he's got his own book, he represented to the children of Israel their leader. However, after Joshua dies, there's the elders that kind of act as in an advisory capacity. But after them, we're going to come up and we're going to have this generation arise that didn't know God. But you stop and you think about the good leaders that Israel has, and you think about their faithfulness, perhaps how it's greater whenever they've got a good leader. And whether it be the judges or whether it be the kings or whether it be someone like Moses or Joshua who steps up into that role of leadership, Israel does better, the people do better, when they've got someone who's faithful standing at the helm. Moses. Moses was trained and he was educated. The first 40 years of his life was spent in the land of Egypt, in the court of Pharaoh. He was instructed, he was taught. You go to look at that. You know, he describes himself as I'm a man who can't speak and I'm not anybody and I have no talent. But you go look at what Stephen says in his sermon. He was a man that was mighty in word and deed in the land of Egypt because of the instruction that he received in the house of Pharaoh. And so in part he was trained and prepared to possess these various tools so that when the time came for Israel to need a deliverer and a leader, Moses was qualified to step into that role. And so he was prepared beforehand. And you look at Joshua. Joshua was Moses' servant. You go back and you read in the book of Exodus and Deuteronomy, he served with Moses. And when you find Moses doing something significant, Joshua's right there tagging along, watching, observing, no doubt asking questions and learning. He's learning faith by watching Moses. And so Joshua, as the next leader of Israel, is really groomed and pruned to step into that role of leadership. Now, the role of leadership just can't be denied, and the significance of having strong, godly leaders, whether it be in the home, where you've got the father and the mother who are examples and leaders in their home spiritually to their children, or in the government, where the people by and large and the culture by and large follow in the steps of the leader. And we see that in the kings, and we see that with various other faithful leaders that arose. Leadership's very significant. However, leaders just don't arise from absolutely nothing. Moses had the training in Egypt. Joshua had the training following around Moses. The elders were around Joshua. And so they had seen Joshua act, and they'd seen Joshua's faith, and they follow in Joshua's footsteps. And we're going to look and find out that after these elders die of the land, no one steps into this role of leadership. And that's really where this generation comes from that doesn't know about God. And so my advice, speaking to parents, would be to train your children and prepare them and groom them to step into roles of spiritual leadership, whether it be when they take a spouse, a husband or a wife, that they may be able to step into that role of leadership for their family, for their children, and that they might not just walk into that unwittingly and not have any idea what they need to do to succeed spiritually. Or I would personally say train young men to be elders one day. Parents, train your children in such a way. You read through the letter to Timothy, 1 Timothy, and you read of Paul's letter to Titus. He says elders are to have all of these characteristics. And yes, Christians are to have a lot of those. But they're to be somewhat of a step above perhaps what many people just implement into their lives. That doesn't just happen arbitrarily. Men don't just arbitrarily step into the pulpit and make qualified preachers. There's time, there's preparation, there's grooming and pruning that has to take place. We see the importance of leaders in the home, in the church, in our nation. Parents need to be grooming their children to one day step into these roles. And I think that that's a large part of the failure of those in the book of Judges, is that there was nobody prepared to step up and to lead God's people. And so God would bring forth various judges. A couple other things. Verse 28, we see, as we go over there, as we read just a moment ago, as Israel gained in strength, they put the Canaanites to forced labor, but they didn't drive them out. There may be decisions that we make in our life. From a physical perspective, perhaps from a monetary perspective, perhaps from a success as the world sees it and as the world defines it, that might be a good decision. However, just because it's a good practical decision doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to be a good spiritual decision. Yeah, it was good practically for the children of Israel to let the Canaanites break their backs doing the physical labor. But spiritually, we see the result of that was they didn't obey God. The Canaanites continue to dwell in the land, and they become somewhat of a spiritual cancer to the people. And so while a decision needs to maybe practically sound, it may at the same time be spiritually foolish. And so we need to have that long-term view in mind when we make decisions. What's best for my career may not be what's best for me as a Christian. And so those are the sort of things that we need to bear in mind. A believer's life, it may have the marks of success, but in the eyes of God, it could be a complete failure. And so that's what we see here with the Israelites. They're largely in control of the land of Canaan at the end of chapter 1. And while we may take a step back and say, you know, they're doing a pretty good thing, they're looking good from our perspective. There's a little bit there they can improve on, but for by and large, it looks okay. Success in our life is not the same thing as obedient faith, and obedient faith is what we need to strive for. And one last observation. Small faithfulness is important. Doesn't seem like anything tragic is taking place at the end of chapter 1. They're largely in control of the land of Canaan, and perhaps their lethargy seems like just a minor infraction. But if you look at really the summary in chapter 3, verses 5 and 6, of the events that take place in Judges 1:1 through 2:5, it's summarized by Judges 3:5, where the sons of Israel lived among the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites. That's from chapter 3, verse 5. That's really a description of everything that we've looked at in Judges 1 to the end of the chapter and the first few verses of chapter 2. However, the next part of the chapter, 2:11 through chapter 3 and verse 4, describes the spiritual significance of what's taking place. They allowed them to dwell in the land, and they took their daughters for themselves as wives, and they gave their own daughters to gods and to their sons and served their gods. And so you really see the summary. You look at as you're reading through the chapter, it doesn't seem like a big deal, but then you take a step back. They let them live in the land. They intermarried with them. And that's really what's going to bring about all of the consequences that we're going to see in the book of Judges. And brethren, that's why we're going to talk more about it in chapter 2. Spiritual compromise is simply not something that we can afford to do. You want to know what happens when you compromise spiritually? You end up like the children of Israel during the time of the Judges. And that's why Paul, when he's speaking, says not a hint of sexual immorality. We compromise so oftentimes. This movie, it's only got a few bad words in it. It's only got a scene or two in it. It's just one little drink. It's just a little white lie. It's just Sunday night. It's just Bible class. It's just a handful of Canaanites, guys. That's what I would have told the children of Israel. We see the effects of leaving just a handful of the Canaanites in the land. And Paul says, a little leaven, leaven the whole lump. And that's what's going to happen to Israel spiritually. It's going to be absolutely detrimental to them. And while faithful in the little things may not sound like the great heading to one's life, in the big scheme of things, it's really the only thing that matters. Just that day-by-day faithfulness and doing those little things. Israel didn't do that when the time came along. And they're going to pay for it throughout the rest of the life of this generation and the following generations for hundreds of years to come. Any thoughts, comments, or questions on chapter 2? Yes, sir. House of Pharaoh.
Yeah, in that formal sense. Mm-hmm. That second 40 years of his life, I think, also was very formative for him, where he saw the plight of the common man and where he tended flocks, so that when he became a leader, not only did he know the formal process, but he understood the feelings of those that he was leading in the hard times that they would have had gone.
Good observation. Maybe that explains his patience with the people. You know, his patience with the people, because he lived for the first 40 years of his life. He was brought up in Pharaoh's house. The second 40 years, he was tending sheep. He just lived as a commoner. And it isn't until that last 40 years that God says, hey, you're ready now. I've got a job for you to do. And you go back, you're reading the book of Acts. Interestingly enough, Moses tried to assume that position of leadership a little bit early. But it wasn't until that second 40 years came along where he lived as a common man, working among the Midianites with perhaps animals and livestock, that he was really groomed and prepared in the eyes of God to step into that role. So, good observation. Thank you for sharing that. Anyone else have anything else they'd like to add to our class? All right, we'll start with Judges 2 next week. If you would, on the way out, if you haven't already, grab the questions for chapter 2 or on the back table to my left, back by the big black box back there, and have those. Go ahead and read through the chapter maybe a couple of times throughout the course of the week if you can, and look forward to our discussion picking up in chapter 2 next Sunday morning. So thank everyone for their attention this morning and participation in our class.